Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
It's the pride of science to be falsifiable. This is what distinguishes it from religion. It's subject to empirical test, and yes, it exposes itself to being falsified. There's a kind of openness there. So the problem is, when science is pressed into duty as authority, and you want to get people to behave a certain way, you have to assert certainty, right? I mean, it would be a very strange sort of authority that insists on the provisional character of its own sort of grasp of reality. So science has to be transformed into something more like religion in order to serve the function that we've assigned it as authority. So that's the basic contradiction we're dealing with. I would call that scientism. It's a science as ideology, as a sort of quasi-religious form of authority.
What I will say of this virus, I think we're in the middle of a massive experiment worldwide.
And that is, where's the guinea pigs?
Maybe. The experiment is, will people listen to scientists? In this case, referring to medical professionals?
Say Anthony Fauci over allergy and infectious disease.
For example, yeah. And it'd be interesting if we all paid attention to what scientists say. Mm-hmm. Maybe the coronavirus will just blow on by. Mm-hmm. With a minimum of cases, and then we kicked its ass for obeying the recommendations of scientists on how to minimize your chances of getting it. That would be, it's an interesting experiment we're in the middle of.
I hope we win.
To prevent disease, we have to build defenses. That's the germ theory. It's thinking like in terms of warfare. It's a very popular paradigm in allopathic medicine, which you would call orthodox medicine. Mm-hmm. And then in the terrain theory, to prevent disease, we have to create health. Okay, that's what are all the needed nutrients for this person? What are the toxins that are in them? How can we get them out? Where are things static because they don't exercise? Where are things injured? There's so many components to health. You can see how, all, like, which one, which, if you're a Rockefeller, which one are you going to fund?
That's exactly what my thinking has been as we go through this entire list. Not to be a nut over here, but again, this is not to say one is completely contrary to the other. When terrain conditions are such, germs could take over.
Sure. I don't know for sure. There's a lot of possibility around it.
So even if these things are not conflicting, you do see that one more lines up with an accepting of ignorance and a generation of fear and a call for help, while the other one is much more about personal responsibility, self-care, and to some degree autonomy. If you accept that, it's easy to see why, even if both are valid and they can work together, one would be amplified and one would be more hidden in the shadows. For that very reason that you just mentioned, what are the interests behind all of this dialogue?
Right.
Rockefeller or whoever.
Despite there being no end in sight, the World Health Organization has praised what it called China's strong and decisive approach to tackling the outbreak.
What they've done has only been possible because of a tremendous collective commitment and will of the Chinese people, from the most bottom level community leaders we met and talked to the governors at the very top. It was an extraordinary, what we call all of government, all of society approach that many of you are feeling because you live here and you operate in this. But it is rare to see that. To the people of Wuhan, it is recognized that the world's in your debt. And when this disease finishes, hopefully we'll have a chance to thank the people of Wuhan for the role that they played in it.
In what ways do you think we will fundamentally change once this is behind us?
Well, I definitely think we'll take the risk of a second pandemic seriously and make some of the foundational investments. And many of those will create medical tools that will be beneficial for diseases, in both infectious diseases and ritual diseases like cancer, that, it's great to make progress on those things. I do think using digital approaches and maybe not traveling quite as much, that even after you get rid of this threat, that people will have been so immersed in it and the tools and techniques will have improved enough that we'll take what would have been 10 to 15 years of digital adoption and cram it into a very short period. Likewise, behaviors around shopping or how people get in touch with each other. And so a lot of it's an acceleration.
One of the things I've seen you talk about online, too, is just how important it is to listen to experts and listen to science. And this is a time when, I was not a very good science student when I was in school. But this is a time, it seems, that, the global scientific community is so critically important, and we're really seeing just how important it is to follow science.
Yes, exactly. And I hope that we can see now the scientific community are stepping up, and they are speaking up more than they have done before, because obviously this is a crisis that require the scientific community to speak up. The role of science is changing now. It's becoming more. People are starting to realize that we are actually depending on science and that we need to listen to scientists and experts. And I really hope that stays, and that is for other crises such as the climate crisis and the environmental crisis, that we actually understand that we have to listen to the scientists.
Well, Greta Thunberg, we really appreciate your time and.
This is Brett. Welcome back to the School Sucks podcast. Today is May 18th, 2021. A year ago, this very week, I commenced a series with my friend Daryl Becker. You're going to hear me mention that about 15 times in the conversation today. In fact, you heard some audio of that just in the intro to today's show. Now, that intro, a lot just happened right there. So I wanted to kind of cover my bases of all of the voices we've heard from, and some of it might actually sound familiar. A big chunk of that was actually pulled from the show that I recorded in the This is a Test series with Daryl a year ago today, almost like to say, look, we made some good predictions about who the players and the voices in this thing were going to be. So the very beginning of the show, that was a voice of reason, Matthew Crawford. It transitioned to some public opinion shapers in the form of the late night finger quotes comedian Stephen Colbert and one of the world's most annoying men, Neil deGrasse Jr. Tyson. You might remember Tyson from various episodes of the Joe Rogan Experience, where he reads from a set of flashcards called Cool Space Facts for Kids into a mirror that he has set up on the table, entirely blocking his view of Joe Rogan's face. All the COVID Follow the Science All-Stars were there too. CNN, Greta, Bill Gates, the WHO, the CDC. So from the people making policy to the people enforcing the public opinion related to that policy. And of course, you also heard a clip of me and Daryl in there as well. So that sets the tone for my conversation with this anonymous member of the Sound Minds Creative Group, who are currently in the pre-production phase of a documentary film called Follow the Science. The subtitle is On Lockdowns and Liberty, and we will discuss that as well. I love talking movies and documentaries, so I offer a lot of suggestions. My guest, who is also a longtime School Sucks listener, so he's willing to put up with me, but he, even if we were complete strangers, he received all of my suggestions very graciously, so I appreciated that. I wanted this show to be out last Monday. We actually recorded it 2 weeks ago, so some of the little specifics that we're talking about might feel dated, but obviously this whole topic is going to be relevant far into our future. This, I think, is our future. As the weather's getting nice and riot season is almost here, lockdowns seem to be taking a backseat to another sophisticated conversation about a new segregation of society around the question of, do you follow the science or do you not? Here's a clip from a comedy show. Comedy, where you can learn more.
We can see our friends' faces again because last week the CDC announced that fully vaccinated people don't need to wear masks in most cases. That is most cases. Remember, you still have to wear a mask if you're traveling by plane, by bus, or by scuba. Now remember, these rules are for vaccinated people only, which sounds great until you realize the CDC made this announcement without any good way to confirm who has been vaccinated. So the CDC is relying on unvaccinated Americans to be honest with each other, which is never going to happen. As one psychologist put it, many will lie. Many are lying, have been lying, adding, I always lie, and the previous statement was true, causing all of the robots' heads to explode. But if you're vaccinated, you don't need to worry about your lying, unvaccinated neighbors. As CDC Director Rochelle Walensky explained.
If you are vaccinated, we are saying you are safe, you can take off your mask, and you are not at risk of severe disease or hospitalization from COVID-19. If you are not vaccinated, you are not safe. Please go get vaccinated or continue to wear your mask. What we are really asking the American people to do is to be honest with themselves and to not remove their masks until they are safe.
Okay. The only thing Americans need to stay safe is to be honest with themselves. We are doomed.
Comedy. Don't you love comedy? What's that old saying? If you're going to tell people repeatedly why they need to live in a surveillance state, you better make them laugh or they'll kill you. That turns out you don't even have to make them laugh anymore. More on that at the end of this monologue. I have another clip. But I do apologize for the delay. I am settling back in now to the Pittsburgh area. You know, I just felt like back in 2018, there was something about this place that was really calling to me. It seemed like a wise decision to go back to New Hampshire last year. And so I had a temporary arrangement there for a while. And I missed this place so much, and I really felt it calling me back to it. And I'm seeing, appreciating a lot of things this time that I missed before. So that's where I'm at. Very happy to be here. And the other thing that has been taking up my time and attention is a new project that I'm working on with our good friend Nathan Frazier called Mindset and Mastery. We are going to be doing another virtual summit June 7th and June 8th. That is a Monday and a Tuesday. I'm giving you a full 3 weeks notice to plan accordingly for that. It will be during the day. Please go to mindsetandmastery.com to learn more. Take your time there, please. Read about what we are putting together. This is, I would say, the perfect marriage of a lot of the work we have done on the topics of personal development and intellectual self-defense coming together in one program. It is basically the highlight reel of the what I see as the most valuable work we've done at School Sucks, with an increased depth and breadth. And this is just as much Nathan as it is me. So we're getting all of his wonderful insights and wisdom from the world of marketing and copywriting. This is something for people like us who already have experienced or are experiencing a fair amount of growth, success, happiness with our various pursuits in life. But we are still needing and willing to audit persistent programming that might be holding us back from reaching our full potential. And if that resonates with you, and you know what? That resonates with everybody. Please check out what we put together at mindsetandmastery.com. That is mindsetandmastery.com. Save your spot for this virtual summit. This event is only going to be for 100 people. Nathan and I just got the site up yesterday, so I am telling you about that today. And that's why I was sitting here holding this podcast so I could gleefully tell you about this next summit with a schedule, with a time commitment that is much more workable for most of you. If you remember when we did Ideas into Action in 2019, I asked people for like 24 hours over 3 days. This is going to be very, very efficient. So again, did I tell you the website? It's mindsetandmastery.com. Go there, get a coffee, sit down, get a coffee. I like Starbucks coffee. I don't know why. And discover what this exciting new presentation is all about. It is the ideal follow-up to all this work that we've been doing at School Sucks through the years. So that's it. Please visit the show notes to learn more about the film Follow the Science. There's a link to their fundraising page and a preliminary trailer. And you can also learn more about SoundMind at soundmindcreativegroup.com. Now, before we talk solutions, let me press on maybe some sore spots you don't even know that you have. I, for some reason, have this obsession with these late night comedians who are, I think, more responsible for shaping public opinion or a certain segment of public opinion. And remember, it's not any single one of them. There is a plethora of these people and these kinds of delivery methods, that whole motif that Jon Stewart invented. If you can laugh at people, it obviously means you are better than they are, which I would say ruin the minds of many people in my generation, in the millennial generation. The pretense of comedy is basically gone. Some of these people at this point are like North Korean state television. Case in point, Stephen Colbert, just under 10 million YouTube subscribers. I'm going to play a clip for you of a recent video. And just to, you know, as a barometer, the like to dislike ratio for this video, which by the time you hear this will have probably over a million views, is 36 to 1. 36 likes for every one dislike. How many carbon copy presentations of this kind of material are there out there? You add up all those late shows that people are watching, you're probably up to 8, 9, 10 million people a night, plus YouTubers like the Try Guys and podcasts that you've never even heard of that are pushing the exact same narrative. If you're tuned out from this stuff, like you haven't checked in with Colbert or any of those guys in a decade, first of all, that's great. Keep it up. But I think it's a good way to put your ear to a certain street in America. You're not even going to believe what you're about to hear. It almost seems, I'm not saying this is the case, but it almost seems like the most practical explanation is that the people trying to ruin this country pulled all of these guys into a room and threatened their families to make them do what they're doing every night. With the exception of the great, very based Bill Maher, who apparently has COVID. Anyway, thanks for listening and take care. Here's a problem. We've got some talk of solutions coming up. And I have to issue a kind of content warning here. In this video clip that I'm about to play, which will certainly remind you of the Hunger Games, there is going to be the promotion of segregating Americans by colors. So you might want to shut this off if that's the kind of thing that you find disturbing.
The CDC got all of us a gift because today they eased indoor mask wearing guidance for fully vaccinated people, allowing them to safely stop wearing masks inside most places. Oh, I love most places. In fact, this is one of the most places I go. We learned the great news this afternoon from the CDC's Dr. Rochelle Walensky.
Today, CDC is updating our guidance for fully vaccinated people. Anyone who is fully vaccinated can participate in indoor and outdoor activities, large or small, without wearing a mask or physical distancing.
Oh my God, I could kiss you. Literally, because we're both vaccinated. I could even kiss you indoors. But I never would.
No.
I never would. I think with this announcement, you're going to see a lot of smiling faces. They may have been smiling before, but now you're actually going to see them. Dr. Walensky continued with her good news.
If you are fully vaccinated, you can start doing the things that you had stopped doing because of the pandemic.
Oh, hell yes! I'm finally going to watch Godzilla versus Kong the way it was meant to be seen. On a plane. I'm getting a little emotional right now, if you can tell. This is my emotional face. I'm getting a little emotional right now because after 14 months of isolation, I'll finally be able to do my favorite things with the people I love the most, by which I mean this show in the Ed Sullivan Theater with you, my audience. Chris, are we back yet?
Not yet.
Am I in the theater right now?
No.
Are you 400 people?
No.
Why aren't you 400 people? But remember, all this good stuff is only for vaccinated people. The CDC is making a huge distinction between Americans who did or did not get the shot. They even put out this actual handy chart. On the left, unvaccinated people with yellow and red shades of risk. But on the right, vaccinated people are all green for the go. We can do everything. Everything maskless, from visit a hair salon to visit a movie theater, even participate in an indoor high-intensity exercise class, which is amazing because I've never been able to do that before. Now, not everybody is comfortable tossing their masks aside yet, and experts want those people to go at their own pace.
I heard you say to Gail King, she said that that people were looking at her funny for wearing a mask, even though she's vaccinated. Is there anything wrong with that? And should people be side-eyeing them?
No, not at all. I mean, people have to make their own personal choice.
Making your own personal choices within reason, of course. All right, here we go. I'm very pleased to welcome to School Sucks a member, an anonymous member of the Sound Mind Creative Group. How are you today?
Doing great. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining me for this conversation. I was realizing that it was almost 1 year ago to the day that I commenced a series with my friend Daryl Becker on the very subject that we're going to be discussing, which is questioning at that time the emerging faith around the COVID-19 pandemic. Here we are 1 year later. That series, by the way, this is a test. We asked a lot of the questions that I think you and your group are going to be tackling in a documentary film that we're going to discuss today. And one of the things that intrigued me about this is very interested in filmmaking, very interested in documentary filmmaking. My whole project started like 15 years ago with the idea of this being a documentary, and I haven't ruled that out yet as a possibility in the future. So I'm always interested in, you know, sharing ideas with people who are at some phase in that pursuit. Is this the first project your group has worked on as far as like first a short and then a feature length documentary?
It is, yeah. We have collaborated on other kinds of projects together, but never as this entity, the Sound Mind Creative Group. It was launched really in response to creating this documentary, and now we're seeing it as having a broader mission, a broader vision of tackling ideas and getting ideas out there that might be heterodox, that might cause people to be a victim of cancel culture. And that's one of the reasons that we're choosing to remain anonymous with this project is we all debated quite a bit about how we were going to handle this. And in part from pleas from our families who said, please don't be out there with your neck on the line.
Yeah.
We decided to form this group and kind of have it as a shield so that we can create this project the way we want to create it. And not lose our incomes in the entertainment industry.
Yeah, absolutely. And have you thought about any kind of a strategy to, I guess, have this project survive and actually get into the eyes and ears of the people, you know, not just the choir, but the people who really need to hear this message and start asking themselves some questions about what we've seen in the world over the last, you know, approaching 14 months now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely a major part of our approach on this. We don't want it to be just preaching to the choir. We want to present it in a way that people will at least begin to question the mainstream narrative that they've swallowed over the last year. And part of that strategy will be the way we present it. We're seeing it kind of like a good conversation, that you don't go into a conversation hitting somebody over the head with your beliefs. You don't say you're wrong about all of this stuff. You've talked about that kind of thing a lot on the show, that we want to approach it so that it's accessible to people. Part of that will be the style of it, having really accessible and clear graphics, having music that draws people in, having a tone that's at times very serious and at times very humorous, and also only focusing on those subjects where we can really make the case. We don't want to be hypothesizing about a lot of conspiracy theories, even though we might entertain them ourselves or agree with them in places here and there. We really want it to be something that the mainstream guy or girl sitting in front of their computer will say, huh, okay, I'd like to watch this. And then, oh, that's interesting. Not, oh, that doesn't make sense to me, and turn it off.
Yeah.
So that's on kind of the aesthetic front. And in terms of distribution, I mean, we're hoping, who knows, but we're hoping that by making it in that vein that I just mentioned, that somebody might, like Netflix, might be willing to pick it up. We're not delusional. we know that the world is as it is right now. We don't expect it to be on YouTube for very long. But, you know, all of that's hard to tell. And a year from now, who knows what the world is going to be like.
Well, yeah, your timing is certainly interesting, as we're seeing a lot of things open back up. In fact, I just heard a story where, you know, CDC recommendations were loosened. And mm-hmm. I think it was Washington, D.C. said, all right, we're lifting these outdoor mask restrictions. And there was like a public outcry from a certain group of people who have just come to, you know, I said recently on a show that I think, I don't want to be this black and white, but I think things divide fairly cleanly right now into people who are over this, and there's, you know, a range within the over this crowd of, you know, people who recognize the severity and all that and just really need to live their lives, all the way to people who are, you know, far more skeptical than that. You know, that's kind of one general camp of people, the over this crowd. And I think the other camp is, you know, maybe it's smaller, but it's very vocal and I would say fairly powerful. There's lots of vested interests and lots of emerging, like I said, religious interests mm-hmm. in the authoritarianism that this crisis delivers. They don't want this to go away.
No.
They don't want it to be over. And that sounds like very speculative and maybe very cynical, but this thing that just happened in D.C., and it's happened maybe in a couple other places as well, where the government says, okay, we're lifting these outdoor mask mandates, and then there's you know, a small but vocal outcry about why that's bad and dangerous. So the timing is interesting because things are loosening up, and it does feel like trying to do what you guys are trying to do a year ago, that would have been, I was really, really apprehensive about doing that series of shows with Daryl Becker, like right at the beginning of this thing, where, you know, the best tone we could really take was like, let's ask questions, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's just be curious about what let's model what we think the questions people should be asking. And maybe that's going to be some of the tone of the film as well. But the effects of this thing are going to be so long lasting that I think even if, hopefully, and this is optimistic, some of the, I don't know, fervor kind of loosens up around this, it's going to be a relevant subject, unfortunately, I think, far into the future. So you guys are talking maybe like a year out from the feature length film?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
The reason we divided it the way we did is that, you know, we have a concern that come fall, there could be a resurgence of cases.
Sure.
And then a resurgence of lockdowns and mask mandates. And so we wanted to get something out as quickly as possible. I mean, ideally, I'd love for this to be out now. I think now would be a perfect time. But, you know, we didn't really start thinking about this until less than 2 months ago. So realistically, getting a feature length out by the fall, it doesn't make sense. But getting a 20 to 30 minute version of it that's a little more kind of concise and hard hitting, that we can do. So we want to do that. And that's also going to kind of be a proof of concept in a way for the larger project.
Sure.
we're in the process of raising funds, so we'll have enough funds to get the short done, and then if we're still needing funds at that point, that project will kind of be the leverage to get to the longer form. And I think you're right. This isn't going away. And that's why the longer form project we see is really important, because that one will dive more deeply into why did this happen? How could we let our rights be so trampled upon? And also kind of drawing the deeper conclusions that it doesn't matter what the crisis is. The solution cannot be authoritarian top-down control.
So we'll come back to that, because I want to get into that towards the end of the conversation, but I want to start by talking more just about SoundMind. So you guys came together fairly recently.
For this project, yeah. I mean, like I said, the core members have collaborated on other projects before, but never as a concentrated production company like this.
And can I just ask how large a group we're talking about?
Right now, we're about four that are the core group, and we're in conversation with a couple of other people to see about bringing them on.
Okay. So I don't know if you heard the show I did recently. It was on the book Why We Drive.
Yes.
I was complimenting the author, Matthew Crawford, on his ability to smuggle some pretty... currently, I would say, subversive ideas into what appeared to be a book about driving. So when you talk about, the style or the presentation of this project and maybe other projects, either you've done in the past or you've done in the future, do you guys see yourself as having more of that kind of role of smuggler when it comes to the ideas of liberty? Like you said, not hitting people over the head. And I won't name examples, but I've seen that done in movies, and it doesn't look good. It doesn't feel good. What is that? At least the initial discussion, maybe embedding some of these really, really important concepts that make up the mission of SoundMind into a film where it could be, so easily dismissed by the public as like, oh, this is some right wing or crazy libertarian kind of treatment of this subject. I'm sure that setting the right tone and creating the right presentation has been an important part of your conversation. So I just want a little bit of detail about what that's looked like so far.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think, all of us that are making this have been kind of in the liberty filmmaking space for many years. And it's always a conversation. How do we get the ideas out there without turning people off? And there's always that dance of, do we just say it, or do we kind of come at it from the side and in a way that people will be open to receiving the idea? And that's a conversation that we've started to have on this project, and I'm sure we'll be having for the next year. Is it that we interview somebody who basically comes out and says individual rights have been violated and that's not okay? Maybe if we've set the tone right from the beginning, having somebody say that can work. I was just thinking about it this morning that one of the issues here about why top-down control doesn't work is because there's not a free flow of information. And I think finding the right analogy for that, figuring out a way to demonstrate that from the side might bring people into it in a different way. And I don't know what that analogy is yet, but some real world example of where a top-down solution can't solve it, but people on the ground working together to figure something out does. And I think those kinds of metaphors really help bring people in to the ideas.
Let me run this idea by you. I'm just wondering if this has been part of your conversations. And it goes back to that Why We Drive show that I did, that I called Century of the Safe. And I said that, the events of 9/11 and certainly the aftermath of that set the tone for a lot of political and social priorities in the 21st century, right? Where safety was the paramount concern, and safety was sort of the trump card in any argument that involves freedom, civil liberties. It's sorry, we're into safety now. At this point, whether we're talking about the wars or the impact of domestic security, enough time has gone by where the average person, even if they are part of this COVID faith, they probably have a fairly realistic assessment about, you know, the failures or maybe even just the inconveniences of some of those things like the TSA. Mm-hmm. They also, assuming that most of these people line up more on the left, see a right-wing version, can remember what a right-wing version of that crackdown, of that invasion of privacy, that disrespect for civil liberties looked like, you know, coming from the Bush administration. So I don't know if there's a way in to maybe generate some sympathy for people who are, at the very least, skeptical of the response to COVID over the last 12 to 14 months, using this similar event. Like, that was, I mean, for most people alive in 2001, that was the crisis of a lifetime, right? That was the scariest thing that had ever happened. And I think it's certainly been replaced by COVID in 2020. And we're seeing a lot of the same kind of like fear-based response and prioritization of safety at all costs. So maybe there's a connection to make there. And I don't know if you guys have discussed anything like that.
We haven't really contemplated that aspect of it. That's definitely something that would be interesting to consider. One of the aspects that's going to be very important in telling this is stories of people whose lives have been impacted by the political decisions, not by the pandemic, but by the choices around it. And I think that's going to be a very important entry point for people to see the emotional cost of all of this and all of these decisions. And, you know, we're of the very firm belief that stories are critical to changing the world, that, you know, libertarian white papers have existed for decades trying to convince the world that freedom is important, and look at where we are.
Yeah. If I could just jump in on that really quickly, you know, if we go back to 2001, one thing that I think in that climate of fear and, you know, reduced capacity for maybe critical or long-term thinking around some of the policies that were being put in place, the same is true today. Stories emerge, a narrative emerges. Obviously, the left in political and social respects has a very, very powerful narrative. Mm-hmm. And the right, you know, behaving in at that time, as far as the response to 9/11, in, you know, a very similar kind of way, had a very powerful, compelling story. I mean, it was, like I've said on School Sucks in the past, it was kind of the plot of the Roadrunner cartoon. Like, these people, they live in caves and they hate our free and capricious lifestyles, so they aim to destroy us singularly for that reason. But it was a story, and it worked. It didn't work forever, but I don't think any ridiculous story like that ever would. But it worked long enough for the state to be able to do everything they wanted to do in the time frame immediately following 9/11. The same has been true with this, even though we see a lot of the narratives and a lot of the things that, you know, I know some people were questioning this time last year, but a lot of those, you know, like safety precautions, that stuff is just falling apart. And then there's all kinds of statistical manipulation that's being exposed. But one thing that libertarians have always lacked in response to all of this coming from both sides is their own effective narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think that you're absolutely right. People's stories are very, very important in being persuasive. Then it becomes this kind of trick of how to do it without coming across like Michael Moore.
Right.
Where it's almost kind of like imbibing the suffering of this person their own gain. And, you know, I've talked about this impulse. I refer to it as the libertarian victory lap, where something bad happens. Like, people get hurt, right? And it's because the state screwed up, and they take to social media to celebrate, you know, the misfortune of people because it makes them feel like they're right. So I've tried to, in my content, podcast and video, not go after people directly emotionally, because it almost, I don't know, to me, and maybe it's just like never really figuring out the right way to do it, it feels like cheating. It feels like manipulation. But it doesn't mean that, you know, I don't understand the effectiveness of stories. And I think it just has to be finding the right way to, I guess, honor and respect the person who is the subject of the story.
Right.
If you're talking about somebody's personal tragedy, and like, let's face it, it's there to make your point, right? Mm-hmm. It's a tricky thing to navigate respectfully.
Well, it makes me think of the use of music in documentaries, because obviously any use of music has an emotional connotation. And there's a very fine line of using it in a way that impacts you but isn't manipulative. And I think that's the line, is figuring out how to use these stories to make the point without crossing that line to where the audience starts to feel like, oh, okay, yeah, I see what they're doing here. And that's going to, I think that is also going to be a conversation we're going to be having day in and day out for the next year. You know, it's tough because to my mind, the stories that should be part of this project are stories that people on the left would inevitably be concerned about if it weren't for the other narrative. Because I think the people who have suffered the most in this crisis have been the, you know, already impoverished, the small businesses, anybody that was already struggled more, and anybody who was doing okay probably managed. So the left should have been concerned about all of those people. And that was one of the shocking things to me over the last year, just watching my Facebook feed and seeing how anytime a story was brought up saying, well, what about this person who's suffering because of the lockdowns? Well, you know, we have to, if we save one life from COVID, then it's all worth it. Well, is it? That's kind of the core question of the project, is where were the trade-offs and where was the discussion about the trade-offs?
Yeah, it really reveals the power of narrative too, just to go back to that for a second, where your allies, no matter who they are, become the people sharing your narrative, right? As I've heard more social justice talking points, I like to add to the end of it, brought to you by Amazon.com, brought to you by Wells Fargo. Like, these are the new allies of people who just 5 years ago were, you know, certainly more focused on the impoverished and economic injustice. And now it's like, screw those people. What does Amazon.com and Netflix and, you know, Morgan Stanley say? There's like ideological alignment there that's more important, that supersedes any other issue at this point, which is just really bizarre. But it reveals a lot about the flexibility that you have when you really have no principles, right? When it's really just about power and narrative control, yeah, you've got a lot of wiggle room.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of who we see this being aimed at is what we call the live and let live crowd. And our perspective is there are a lot of people out there who are libertarian-ish. You know, I think the average person, if you ask them, should people be allowed to live their lives the way they want to, would say, sure. Then when you dig down and you start to ask, well, should they be able to do drugs? Well, I don't know about that. Should they be able to be a polygamous relationship? Well, I don't know about that. But the point is, the core values of most people, I think, in America, and really the American spirit as it's always been experienced, is one of let people alone to live their lives. And so that's the zeitgeist that we want to tap into, so that not just the core libertarian crowd, but the whole kind of concentric circles moving out from that of people on the right and left can hear the message and say, yeah, maybe what we did doesn't make sense. And maybe it doesn't make sense to do that again in the future, regardless of what the issue is. You know, because my deeper concern is that now that this has been tried, now that people have been put into fear and governments have seen, okay, well, if we do this, then we can get away with murder, then, you know, anything goes. When they say, well, we've got to, like, I think you talked about this in the Why We Drive episode, for purposes of global warming, we have to now cut transportation down by half. So, you know, you're not going to be able to drive your car anymore. You've got to take the bus. People have just kind of sat down and given up their rights in this crisis, and the governments have seen that they can get away with it. So that's our deeper concern with this project.
Yeah, that was actually why I called that series that I started a year ago. It was one of the reasons. This is a test, which was also kind of a play on words, since a lot of it was questioning the use of PCR technology in determining whether or not people have COVID. This is a test is also a reference to that Michael Malice quote that I think I used in that same show, that over the last year, you know, a lot of really despotic and authoritarian people have learned exactly what most Americans, most people around the real world really will put up with, right? Mm-hmm. That there is no line in the sand. And I remember saying when that was the narrative emerging on Facebook, I saw this a lot from like high school and college friends. It's like, you're a good person if you do these things. You're a good person if you do these things that you're told to do because science. And, you know, my comment to one of them is like, well, I get that it feels good to say that, but you should probably establish now what your line in the sand is. And I think at this point, you know, over a year into this thing, a lot of people have no line in the sand, right?
Yeah.
Two masks, okay. No questions asked. Two masks outside after being vaccinated, I think that is the situation in some places. I don't think I'm exaggerating. So we talked a lot about, you know, the power of story and the narrative that you're looking to create. You know, to I know it's it's a fallacy to say appeal to emotion, but it is part of what you have to do in a documentary is connect with people on an emotional level. So we've talked about some strategies for doing that. I guess the backbone of the film would probably be the data, right? Because it's always going to have to come back to that. What has that started to look like? Who are you looking to, or what sources are you looking to primarily to build out the research foundation or backbone of the documentary?
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole idea from this came as a result of a Tom Woods episode. He was interviewing Ian Miller, who's done amazing charts, basically showing, he's done charts from all around the world, but they show contrasting areas that have had mask mandates and lockdowns. A good example is California and Florida. And it shows very clearly that these mandates have done nothing to impact the curve of cases and deaths. So in that episode, Tom basically said, you know, somebody really should do a documentary about this, and I'd really get behind it if somebody did. And I thought, yeah, somebody really should. That would be great. And then like 5 seconds later, I thought, well, why shouldn't I do it? So then I got on the phone with a couple of my buddies, and that kind of set us in motion. So yeah, Ian Miller is somebody that we're going to lean heavily upon. We're also in discussion with the group Panda, pandata.org. Nick Hudson is somebody that we really would like to have as a major part of the project. Their data is just really amazing, and he's a very articulate spokesman for getting the data out there. And the contrast between seeing that these choices have done nothing to solve the problem with the people who have suffered as a result of these choices. It's like these people have suffered for absolutely nothing. You know, if it had some impact, then you could say, well, okay, you know, it some people's lives were saved by these choices. It's too bad these people lost their businesses, but it's a choice we had to make. Maybe a case could be made. I personally don't think so, but maybe a case could be made. But the truth is, when you look at the data, there's no impact from all of these choices. And I think seeing that contrast plus the politicians and pundits saying we have to do this because the combination of those three things, I think it's a bit of a shocker.
Yeah, well, I mean, we see a lot of the media's incentives to keep promoting this is like that Project Veritas stuff that was revealed, that technical director hidden video. where he said, you know, if we took the death counter off, we were told to put it back on. So, yeah. And if you I forget, like I was watching some YouTube clip of some CNN thing. Oh, I wanted to see the response to the Joe Rogan, Dave Smith thing, like how the mainstream media was treating that story.
I want to play you something that Joe Rogan said to his millions of listeners. It's important for that reason. We'll discuss on the other side.
If you're like 21 years old and you say to me, should I get vaccinated? I go, no. If you're a healthy person and you're exercising all the time and you're young and you're eating well, like, I don't think you need to worry about this.
So, doctor, with all due respect to the noted public health expert Joe Rogan, and for that matter, Tucker Carlson, who this week is equating putting masks on children with child abuse, what do all the folks on the sidelines who aren't physicians, who aren't in the business of public health, what do they need to know about those comments?
Well, those comments were unleashed by a president who left some very, very malignant legacies. Brian, you know, obviously inciting people to the insurrection that we saw on January 6th was a major problem left to us by the former president. But the other legacy he left to us was this ability for people to speak publicly the worst misconceptions, the worst mistruths, the most dangerous messages to the public you would possibly imagine. I imagine, and I've been talking to colleagues about this, were it not for Donald Trump, even the likes of Tucker Carlson or Joe Rogan or the school in Miami that won't hire vaccinated teachers would not be getting away with this absolute nonsense that they're getting away with right now. So he's left us, Donald Trump, a poison pill that is really undermining our ability to get this pandemic under control. And a lot of blood and a lot of lives are on his hands and on the hands of people who continue to propagate this nonsense to the American people. If I could make a plea, it would be turn away from these charlatans, turn toward the CDC and other legitimate sources of information. If we don't do that, a lot of us are going to face some terrible consequences in the near future, Brian.
And I go to watch the CNN clip, and sure enough, it's still there. It is still on the screen. They won't take it off. So you have that informing a fair amount of public opinion, and people can say whatever, CNN, MSNBC, their ratings are plummeting after Trump. But how many television and online news sources, how many podcasts are promoting that exact same narrative, right? Like, there are a lot of people who are still very, very bought into this. And like I said, in recent shows, you can really see the distinction between like the city culture around this. And there's lots of reasons for that. You know, people in closer proximity, people who maybe experienced, you know, larger spikes or the appearance of larger spikes last year. And rural culture, where people are more spread out, they tend to be more, you know, live and let live. And I see that contrast almost every day traveling between, you know, Butler, PA, where I've been, and the city of Pittsburgh, where I'm slowly like relocating back to. So or near there on the outskirts. So, yeah, there's that. There is also this problem of data selection, where the people who are in these political positions, so you have the media operating on their incentives to just stoke fear, keep people tuned in, like you are dependent on whatever your news source is for the next piece of bad news that you need to know. You're addicted to that. That informs public opinion. That leads to public outcry. That leads to a political response. And obviously, you have a lot of people with vested interests who are now, you know, Dr. Fauci at the top of this whole structure. But there are lots of people getting airtime on networks, you know, podcast guests, you know, being written about or getting quoted in, you know, mainstream online news sites, who have reached a level of celebrity and relevance and importance that they never thought they would have in their lives. Right. Like Dave Smith said in a recent podcast, like nobody's ego is prepared for what happened to Anthony Fauci over the last year, right? Nobody's ego is prepared for that. So you have this whole nexus of vested interests in keeping this story going. And in that environment, I think when there's, you know, all of this data and some studies conflict others, it's very easy to say, well, that's a study. This is a study. They're both studies. I like this study. I'm going with this study. This is the study I'm showing the mayor. This is the study I'm showing the governor. This is the study that is going to be the one that is used to actually influence policy here. So it all leads me to this question of when you're going to criticize somebody, I think it is intellectually, the most intellectually sincere thing is to try and humanize them first, right? And to try and obviously steel man their position. It's also very easy, especially in setting up a narrative, whether it's a podcast or a documentary, that things break into very clear protagonists and antagonists. Mm-hmm. So have you thought at all, or has there been any discussion about, like, how do you humanize the people who are making these decisions, like, on the government level? I mean, it's harder to do with some of them, like the governor of New York, for example, who's deliberately covering things up. But, you know, I think a lot of these people are just like, we need to make it look like we're doing everything that we can, even to the point where it becomes performative to the absurd. That's maybe more the case in things I've seen in Canada or Great Britain. But there's plenty of cities, there's plenty of mayors who've completely lost their minds around this thing, too. But that's not humanizing them. So I don't know if there's been any efforts to think about ways to, like, sympathize with these people first before demonstrating with data, with stories, why they're so catastrophically wrong.
Yeah, I think that will be important. I mean, I think about fiction, you know, narrative stories and how I don't find a story compelling or convincing when the villain is presented in black and white. It's much more interesting to me when they have sympathetic aspects, when you can almost identify with the villain and understand why they're doing what they're doing. And I think it's going to be important in telling the story for there to be heroes and villains, because that's the struggle. The question is how they're framed. And I think you're right that we don't want to present selective evidence the way they've presented selective evidence. So understanding why the decisions were made, how fear generated those decisions, is going to be important. I don't know how thoroughly we'll be interviewing people on the opposition. I'm sure we'll try to do that some. But, you know, they kind of make their case. They have their case out there already in the news and in all the, you know, all the interviews that they've done. So we'll probably draw heavily upon that. We may try to bring some people in who are in opposition to the ideas that we're presenting, but we'll see about that.
I think it's interesting if there was a way that these people could actually, like, dialogue.
Yeah, that's true.
You've got 90 minutes or so to do this. So Obviously those are tough choices. But I mean, no matter what a person believes, I think if you just kind of put them a few steps away from two people with opposing views, like having an argument, it's pretty difficult to go, nah, my person won, if they didn't, right? Like, there are just lots of ways to see a person eating shit in an argument. I think if you are just, like, you know, one way in the thing, that's easier to dismiss as bias. But if you put two people head to head in, and yeah, it's really, really difficult to, I'm doing a lot of thinking out loud, but it's really, really difficult to do that in a time efficient way in a documentary film. But Even if there was, like, one or two good examples of, like, will you pro lockdowner go head to head with this, you know, more liberty minded or skeptical person, two examples I think could be, like, pretty impactful.
Yeah. That's a good idea. Something we'll definitely explore.
Yeah. It's like I always said about, you know, fighting with people who were, you know, really opposed to my views. It's like, I'm not actually arguing with them. Like, I wouldn't have that argument if there wasn't an audience. And I know Tom Woods has said the same thing about, you know, going after people online. Like, it's not about them. They are a demonstration.
Right.
So how you get people to agree to being demonstrations of why certain ideas are wrong and appear in a film, that's tricky, right? Because a lot of people will just do, I can't even, I won't dignify that with a response kind of approach. But I bet there are some people, I bet there are certainly people who are out there who are sincere enough in their support of what we've seen over the last year that they would agree to something like that. I don't know who those people are. again, you have that vested interest problem, right? There's like so much incentive to just like keep this narrative. They don't want the possibility of looking like they're wrong or questionable anywhere. But I don't know. I think it might be an interesting search.
Yeah. And just to pick up on something that you just said, I think we all went through this process when this first started. I mean, I know you did. You were pretty public about it of being in a space of fear and reacting to it and maybe making choices that weren't always in line with our core principles. And
right. So
I think that really having that be a part of the story is going to be important because fear is a really powerful motivator. And I'm sure, you know, I wouldn't have wanted to have been a politician during this whole thing. It would be very difficult to make choices that really were helpful to people. So I think recognizing that people made choices out of fear is a core part of all of this. But I think the broader principle is that fear is not a good enough reason to make those kinds of choices. That's our obligation as humans, is to step back from the fear and say, is this fear justified? Does it make sense to proceed with this choice?
Absolutely. So in our preliminary conversation, you talked a little bit about the full-length project dealing with language. Like language that was used to put people into that state of fear. Can we just explore that a little bit, like how that would show up or what you think the most persuasive aspects around the use of language as a manipulative tool?
Well, certainly just the bromide follow the science is an important one. And that's part of the reason the title of, I'm not sure we mentioned the title, but right now the title is Follow the Science: On Lockdowns and Liberty. So On Lockdowns and Liberty is kind of a subtitle. Mm-hmm. But we felt like it was important to kind of deconstruct that phrase, follow the science. That's not so much about putting people in fear, but it's certainly used to justify all of the choices. And it's a piece of language that people have kind of taken as a slogan. Actually, you mentioned Matthew Crawford. I just listened to a podcast with him kind of deconstructing this whole notion of follow the science that I thought was very insightful.
With the pandemic, the question of political legitimacy that hangs over rule by experts, which is a longstanding question, has come to mass awareness. It's kind of on everyone's minds. So we've seen this extraordinary extension of expert jurisdiction over every domain of life, really. So, of course, this entails really a transfer of sovereignty from democratic to technocratic institutions. I think it also involves something deeper, which is a delegitimizing of common sense as a guide to action. And have now quite a prominent pattern of government by emergency that I think extends beyond the pandemic. And resistance to this is often characterized as anti-science. And I think the basic difficulty is that you can't really follow the science because science doesn't lead anywhere. It can illuminate various courses of action. For example, by quantifying the risks that attend each, it can help to specify the trade-offs, but it can't make the choices for us. And I think pretending otherwise is a way for decision makers to kind of avoid responsibility for the choices they make on our behalf.
So it's part, in a way, of this devolving of power upwards to technocratic or expert bodies that bypasses having a political discussion about them and actually delegitimizes people's instincts or people's natural intuitions on how to behave.
Yeah, that's I think the sort of the deepest current here is, is experience an adequate guide to reality? And, you know, the answer is yes and no. But clearly there's a kind of blossoming infatuation, I would say, among sort of institutional players in the West and sort of centrist opinion in infatuation with Chinese-style governance, where, you know, democracy is very much in bad odor these days. And I think you see people looking to China for a model of social control.
So I definitely want to come back to China. But just to spell this out then, for a lot of people watching, this has been a weird year because people may have felt they were pro-science in favor of all of the wonderful discoveries that science has given to us and helping with people's health and all sorts of things. But they may have felt skeptical of some of the consensus scientific opinions, and they were hard to balance those two impulses. And you talk about a distinction between science and scientism. And I wonder if you could just explain what that means.
One way that, you know, it's the pride of science to be falsifiable, right? This is what distinguishes it from religion.
You can prove it wrong, in other words.
Yes, it can be. It's subject to empirical test. And yes, it exposes itself to being falsified. It's there's a kind of openness there. So the problem is when science is pressed into duty as authority, and you want to get people to behave a certain way, you have to assert certainty, right? I mean, it would be a very strange sort of authority that insists on the provisional character of its own sort of grasp of reality, right? So science has to be transformed into something more like religion in order to serve the function that we've assigned it as authority. So that's the basic contradiction, I think, that we're dealing with in, and that is I would call that scientism. It's a science as ideology, as a sort of quasi religious form of authority.
So it's science shorn of its natural humility or openness to being questioned.
Science got big in the really around World War II and thereafter. Became highly institutionalized and bureaucratized. And part of the problem is that you simply need a lot of resources and a lot of collaboration to do science at the cutting edge. But this has had the effect of...
So just to expand on that, Matt, so you tell the story of how when you were a kid, your dad used to do science experiments and they actually became pretty famous. What was that about?
Yeah, so my dad was a physics professor at Berkeley, and he used to do experiments around the house. He called it kitchen physics, just, you know, investigating things that you can do with your own, see things with your own eyes and use things around the house to do experiments. And in retrospect, I'm impressed that he made time to do this even while working at the frontiers of particle physics at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. And I think it was simply for the intellectual refreshment of doing science in that kind of intimate scale where things are directly accessible without, large instruments.
So it's a kind of reminder of the individual inquiry component of science, which gets lost if you're in a team of hundreds and hundreds of people.
Sure. And it's really the image we have of what science is, right? This picture of Galileo going up into the Leaning Tower of Pisa to drop things and see how fast they fall. And then, of course, you know, later Galileo was brought before the Inquisition for his establishing that the Earth revolves around the sun. And according to the lore, he recanted to save his skin, but then under his breath, he says, but it does move. So this is, I think this anecdote sort of crystallizes this dichotomy we have of here's science with its devotion to truth. And over here is authority, whether ecclesiastical or political. And the two were kind of really opposed. And so that's an image that stands in stark contrast to the present where precisely science is invoked as the authority. So that just kind of brings, crystallizes the basic problem.
So we've moved from the point which you described your dad was at making experiments at home to science where, as you mentioned, the CERN, for example, the Nuclear Research Institute in Switzerland is miles and miles in size, and it needs huge institutions and governments to even enable experiments to happen. And the whole process of funding and group corporate experiments has just changed the nature of science into something quite different.
In the longer form project, that's certainly something that we're going to dive into, is what does it mean to make decisions based on science and whose evidence are we listening to? Just going back to your original question, that's an important aspect, is kind of deconstructing those kinds of phrases. Also, things like flatten the curve, social distancing, all of these things that kind of became a part of our everyday vocabulary.
That basically installed programs, right?
Yes.
Our words become our thoughts. Mm-hmm. And it's the follow the science thing is really interesting, because in the shows that I was doing with Daryl a year ago, the second episode dealt with germ versus terrain theory of disease.
Right.
And I couldn't understand why it was like an either or choice. And I'm not sure that a lot of people are even suggesting that it is. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like, outside of like very unavoidable cases, the narrative that emerged about COVID last March, last April, was that terrain wasn't a thing, right? So like you're just to combine follow the science and the state of fear, you have no control. You are a victim of fate with this thing, right? That was the initial presentation. There's nothing that you can do to, strengthen your immune system. There's nothing you can do to give yourself better odds in a proactive way to encountering this COVID-19. Mm-hmm. So there was very, very, very little outside of like wash your hands. And then by April, we saw the wear a mask controversy emerge as well. But follow the science is that the science is also very narrative driven, because huge aspects of important science were left out of the conversation to promote that state of fear, that state of powerlessness. And I said, like, if you had to pick one, right, if you had to pick germ theory of disease or terrain theory of disease, if it was an either or choice, which one do you think that the media and politicians would run with? Mm-hmm. Right. Like, oh, that you have control, or that you need us.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was one follow the science example that I found troubling.
Yeah. And something that you just said made me think about, I think an important aspect of this too will be presenting. So what would an alternative have been? What would we have considered a decent approach to handle this crisis? Hmm. And it seems to me like public officials saying the kind of thing that you just said, make sure you're taking care of yourself, make sure you're, you know, washing your hands, you're avoiding situations where you could possibly get sick. The terrain theory writ large would have been an important aspect of this, supporting the larger picture of people having the ability to make choices that really serve their lives and figure out how to deal with this on an individual level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would have been an important choice for the politicians and the media to have made in terms of really helping people cope with this. And obviously that's not in their interest to do that, but that's what would really have helped to solve this, not top-down solutions.
You think if there was like a genuine interest in public health, that the operation wouldn't be to like spike people's cortisol continuously for months, right? Like 9/11 every day for months. And like the only public figure, I mean like famous person or otherwise, that had any kind of you know, don't panic narrative right from the beginning was Drew Pinsky. So I assume maybe Adam Carolla, because, you know, they're podcast partners, I assume he probably had it too. But I wasn't checking in with him at the time. But as I went back and was kind of looking, you know, to do those shows a year ago and looking at like what people were saying and how much dissent is there in this early on, Dr. Drew was like the only person who emerged as, you know, don't panic.
That's interesting. I hadn't really paid attention to what he had to say. That might be somebody interesting to bring into the conversation.
Yeah, I think so. And he also had COVID. He has been attacked for some of those statements early on for telling people not to panic. And you could probably go on YouTube and find, like, you know, compilation of Dr. Drew being wrong, finger quotes, about COVID. I think he would be a good voice. Can we, can I just ask you about that as an aside? Like, have you thought about, you know, a celebrity presence?
There are two people actually that we're looking at approaching. One would be JP Sears, because he has done some really great comedic sketches about COVID itself. And we feel like it's important to bring some humor into this, some satire. And again, it's going to be interesting to figure out how to walk that line, because satire is certainly a form of jabbing against the opposition, but maybe in a way that's less in your face. Mm-hmm. We're looking at possibly bringing him in for the short form project as well as the long form. For the long form, we're looking at approaching Mike Rowe.
Yeah.
Because we think he's had some really great things to say about this, has been very reasonable and level-headed. And he's somebody that has some appeal across the political spectrum.
True. Yeah, absolutely. You also mentioned Dave Portnoy to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's somebody that one of my partners has brought up. I don't know a whole lot about him, but I know that they've raised an enormous amount of money for people who have suffered as a result of the political choices. And that's something that I think is really important. So that's something that we'll be looking into.
So I have one more question, kind of a controversial question. People might not like me asking this. In this time, you know, kind of, listening to a lot of things that like Tom Wood says or Dave Smith says or even Pete Quinones on, you know, The Free Man Beyond the Wall, like now is not the time for retreat, right? Now is not the time to retract. And I think that was one of the big mistakes that I've made along the way. And, you know, even found myself kind of thinking that way after January 6th, like I better start paying attention to who my associations are. The things that I'm saying, you know, they're going through and making transcripts of podcasts, supposedly, and looking for certain keywords or certain topics of conversation. But you didn't ask my opinion about this, but I just want to ask if you guys have had any discussion about it. The word liberty in the title.
Mm-mm. We did have a discussion about it.
Yeah.
It's certainly a keyword, and it's such a shame to me that that word has become associated with kind of an alt-right perspective, when to me that's the complete opposite. You know, that's the word that encapsulates for me the whole idea of human freedom and human flourishing.
Yeah.
You know, right now we have it there as something that kind of is poetically in opposition to lockdowns. So lockdowns and liberty kind of rolls off the tongue. Mm-hmm. It's certainly something that we have had a discussion about, whether it's going to trigger people who normally would avoid these kinds of documentaries. Mm-hmm. You know, for the time being, we feel like the opposition that's presented creates an interest, and so it feels like it's something usable.
Yeah,
but it may change. It may change as we move along.
Yeah. My opinion on it, unsolicited, was in a 20 to 30 minute documentary that might be more about rallying troops and building support for a bigger project. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's in there. And I just had this like amusing thought before we started, like, you know, kind of reading about the aim of the documentary and the subject matter that it's going to be covering. It would be funny if it was just called Follow the Science. That would amuse me. for sure.
Yeah, you know, that was the original intention, actually. And then we received feedback from somebody who said, you know, but then you're going to turn off the opposite crowd. Anybody who's opposed to lockdowns is going to see that and think, oh, well, that's propaganda from the left.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why we added in the subtitle. So it's a fine line to walk. There are a lot of decisions we're going to have to make to figure out how we appeal to the people that are the choir, who really need and want to see this in order to have the information they need to combat this, but also bring in the people who normally wouldn't agree.
Yeah. I'm sure most of the people in my audience who are listening to this would be on board with a project like this. Is there a way that people can get involved really at any level? I know you guys are trying to raise money. We should talk about that and, you know, where you see those funds going once once they're acquired.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a number of ways people can reach out to us. Our fundraising page is fundraiser.com/followthescience, and fundraiser is spelled FUNDRAZR. And there on that page, we have a 5-minute trailer that kind of gives a sense of what we're doing with the film. It's a bit more hard hitting than the film itself probably will be. We have various levels of perks, from just, you know, $20, I think, is to see the early premiere of the film, all the way up to $5,000 as an angel investor, which would give people a co-executive producer credit. But we also, in between there are perk levels where people can become part of a community that we're building, where people can give us feedback. They'll be able to watch things as we go along, and we're really planning on doing this as a kind of decentralized knowledge project. We want to get as much information as we can from our supporters, stories of people who have suffered at the hands of these policies, and just information and tips from people that's going to really feed us as we move along in the process. Mm. Also, our email address, if people want to reach out to us, is soundmindcreativegroup.
Yeah.
At protonmail.com. And, you know, if somebody's not able to contribute financially, but has, you know, have some information, knowledge, or if they've got skills that they want to share with us, that would be great. We've already started receiving emails from people who have animation and graphics knowledge, music. We've got a lot of those things already in motion, but we're certainly open to hearing from people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with a lot of what I'm hearing from like Dave and Tom, that like this is the central issue to people who are liberty minded right
absolutely.
Now. I mean, I think as somebody who has a project about something else, it's like, I don't want to say it's tone deaf, because I think that all of these things are still important. And I think that, you know, people taking care of themselves and developing as individuals is still important work to do at a time like this. But as far as, you know, policy or as far as political priorities are concerned, this is the thing. So I'm sure you're getting a lot of requests or a lot of interest in
yeah.
people looking for ways they can help out. What do you see? I know this is one of the things that you have to secure for this project. What do you see as the role of a director in a film like this?
The most important thing is having a unified vision.
Yeah.
Right now we have a director on board. We're not sure if he's going to be the sole director or if we'll have some other voices in there. But it's really important to us that, just as a small example, that the interviews be filmed in a way that it's not just a talking head sitting there moving their mouth.
Yeah.
This director we have on board has done amazing documentary work. And he does it very cinematically. He sets up the shots in a way that it's beautiful and appealing to the eye. He interviews in a way that really brings out the depth of the person. Not just, you know, asks a question and then they talk.
Yeah.
And then edits it in a way that it's appealing engaging. And that's, you know, part of the whole aesthetic that we want to aim for with the documentary is one that's very contemporary, very engaging, very energetic. Mm-hmm. So having somebody with that depth of experience on board is going to be really important to making this be more than just, you know, people moving their mouths and sharing opinions. It's got to be something that lifts off the page and really brings somebody into the story. To my mind, that's one of the most key roles that we can fill in the project.
Yeah. Yeah. The reason why I asked is because, like, in a, you know, a feature fictional film, you know, this goes all the way up to, you know, Stanley Kubrick, all the way down to somebody who's just hired to do a job and shoot, you know, first unit primary cast scenes. Mm-hmm. But in documentaries, I think it is much more of an auteur thing where you need that unified vision from pre-production to the production to the post-production and assembly of the film, right? Yep. Because you need a kind of harmony through all parts of the process. So a documentary film director has much more authorship over the story than I think what is typical in fictional films. So I was just curious as to, you know, what you think that person looks like. But it sounds like you're already on your way to you have a person.
We have a person. We'll see. We're still conversing with him about how fully his role will be involved. But certainly it will be important to have. I think you're right. Having kind of a person with the singular vision is pretty critical.
Absolutely.
And you had asked also about other aspects of how the money will be used. I think that's important to share with people. We debated about what the budget would be on this. Obviously, you know, documentaries are made for next to nothing. Nowadays, it's easy to do it with the technology as it is. But our feeling about this is that this is such a critical issue and it needs to be made in a way that is high quality at the highest level of professionalism. So, you know, our budget for the short version is $100,000, and our budget for the long form version is going to be somewhere in the range of $500,000. We feel like that's going to enable us to really make this in a way that's going to be engaging, contemporary, exciting, and reach people rather than just be, you know, another one of those documentaries that has that's a flash in the pan and then disappears. So that money will go toward a director, producers doing all of the day-to-day grind work that needs to be done to get the project completed. And an animator is going to be really key because the data, you know, it's not enough to just put a chart up and talk about.
Oh, yeah, totally. You know, totally.
It's got to be done in a way that makes it easy to understand at a glance. Mm-hmm. And also visually engaging, you know, something that really pops off of the screen.
Yeah.
And obviously, a good score is going to be important. That requires money. And then, you know, all of the legal and insurance and all of the stuff that you don't even think about that's key to getting this done well. So yeah, that's basically where that stands.
Excellent. Yeah, I can see it taking shape. And yes, the legal is going to be very important.
Yes.
But yes, I can see it taking shape from your description. So that's awesome. All right. Well, we can leave it there. That's a lot of great information. I'll make sure that the link to the trailer and the fundraising page is up in the show notes. And can I throw up a link to SoundMind Creative Group as well?
Yeah, actually, that's important because that's where our portal for receiving stories from people is. That our website, soundmindcreativegroup.com, is where people can send us stories as well as the email address, but that's kind of a more formalized way for us to receive the information.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to seeing what happens next, and I appreciate the conversation. Maybe we can follow up sometime later in the summer.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Brett.
All right. Take care.
three,